Hello, 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 and welcome to the Local Edition on a Monday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Robayo. Jason Doe has the night off. Coming up in the second half of the show, an independent review finds a culture of violence inside New York's prisons, major failures, and how the state tracks the use of force. But first, communities in and around Hancock, New York, are continuing to clean up after a powerful storm tore through the region on Saturday evening. The National Weather Service confirmed that an EF1 tornado traveling nearly 16 miles from Sanford area in Broome County toward Hancock in Delaware County, bringing winds up to 95 miles per hour. The storm brought down trees and power lines, damaged homes and outbuildings, and left some roads difficult to travel. As of this afternoon, NYSEG is reporting 1,008 customers are without power in Delaware County and 1,282 customers without power in Broome County. Radio Catskills reporter Kimberly Izar is in Hancock today speaking with residents and seeing the damage firsthand. Kimberly, welcome to the program. You're in Hancock now. What are you seeing around you?
Yeah, so I'm in Hancock, New York right now. And I'll say that, you know, on the main highways, like Route 97 heading north to Hancock and then and County Road 28, the roads are for the most part pretty clear. There are some, you know, fallen branches and tree debris kind of along the side of the road. But for the most part, like travel has kind of resumed since Saturday. It's really when you start venturing off to some of the dirt paths and some of the side roads that things like start looking a little bit apocalyptic, to be honest. It was quite scary. I got a tip from one resident who I spoke with briefly that said that, you know, along John Milk Road in Long Eddy, heading up to Hancock, there was significant tree damage. And it was there where, you know, I spoke to one resident. His name was Jim Milk. He lives in the Long Eddy area. And he said that he had never seen anything like the tornado that we witnessed on Saturday. The trees on the road on his way to his house are hemlock trees. So they've been there for at least 200 years. And what I saw was so many of these trees were completely toppled over. The tree roots itself were completely ripped out of the ground. And his grandson was actually flying, you know, like a drone to see the full extent of the damage. And you can see in the actual drone footage that the damage actually goes for at least several hundred yards. So here's Jim recalling the night of the tornado and kind of how he remembers the night.
We heard the tornado alarms go off. Of course, we think, well, we're up in the hills. There's not going to be any tornado around here, right? So we ignored it. And we looked out our window and saw just a wall of rain coming down, coming across. So we went back in the house. Didn't see an actual, like, a tornado or anything. But, boy, my daughter was coming in from North Carolina that night.
On Saturday,
yeah. Oh, and so I tried to get down John Milk Road, and you could see this was completely covered. It was like driving into a bush. It was completely covered over. So then I cut my path up the hill, so that she could come around 28 and come down the hill to the house. Yeah.
We're reporting that NYSEG is still saying that folks are still without power in some areas in Broome County.
Yeah, some of the folks that I spoke to have started to resume power, like Jim, who we just heard from. He lost power immediately on Saturday night, and then he told me that he didn't have power pretty much like throughout the whole weekend, but as of this morning at 11 a.m., he finally got power. But yes, according to the NYSEG outage map, there are still more than, I believe, 1,000 residents in Delaware County, and then about 1,280 customers in Broome County that still don't have power as of 4 p.m. today. I also spoke to the town of Hancock supervisor, Jerry Vernold, who said that, you know, there's still hundreds of residents who still don't have power. There's lots of fallen telephone poles and trees. So he's anticipating that hopefully residents will have power, you know, by 11 p.m. tonight. But I think, you know, NYSEG will continue to send out updates as they have more information.
And as far, I'm sure there's crews out there now cleaning up, as doing storm recovery there. Have you been able to speak to any of the emergency officials there?
Yeah, I had a chance to speak with the Hancock Fire Chief, Blaze Bojo. He pretty much said that the most significant impact in Hancock happened in the north and eastern parts of Hancock, particularly along Pease Eddy Road, which is a more suburban residential part of the town. Pretty much he said that, you know, after the storm happened, they immediately activated rescue mode operations. There was, you know, like an emergency advisory sent out for the area. There were no non-essential travel during that time. And then since then, it's been lifted and people are back out on the road. But here's some of what Chief Bojo said about the rescue mode operations.
Basically, after the storm hit, we immediately went into rescue mode. So we worked with local DP, the fire department, as the primary agency, worked with local DPW crews, private contractors, and utility companies to start to gain access to the Pease Eddy Road area because we were completely blocked off from there due to downed trees. Once gaining access to that, we started search and rescue operations, searching homes that were damaged, checking on residents, and ensuring that there were no injuries. At that point, we began additional actions to protect life and property, including attempting to clear the road so we could have access for emergency vehicles.
Now, one thing I'll note is that because there's still so many residents without power, NYSEG is planning to do a bottled water distribution. Today, actually, NYSEG is providing bottled water to two fire stations. One is going to be at the Hancock Fire Station located at 24501 State Highway in Hancock, and at the East Branch Fire Station at 29 Birch Street in East Branch. That water distribution was supposed to kick off around 3 p.m. earlier today. I was at the fire station at that time, and they were still waiting actually on the bottled water. But I would just, you know, continue checking with the local village and town social media pages to see if they've received that water distribution by now.
So what should anyone who's traveling through Hancock know before heading out?
I would just keep in mind that there's still a rescue and recovery operations in place. So depending on where you're going in the area, there still might be some fallen trees and some telephone poles. So just go slow while you're on the roads because there still might be stuff and debris along the highways and whatnot. I would also just keep in mind that tomorrow, I believe that there is a severe potential thunderstorm that could be coming to the Hancock, Delaware County area in the afternoon and evening. So one thing that the town supervisor, Vernal, told me is if folks can stay indoors, please stay indoors, don't get near any trees, and just generally to move with caution if possible.
That was Radio Catskills reporter Kimberly Izar joining us from the Hancock area as residents and crews continue recovering from Saturday's destructive storm. And like Kimberly said, a reminder that another round of severe thunderstorms is possible Tuesday afternoon and evening across the southern tier and parts of central New York, the western Catskills, and northeast Pennsylvania. Damaging winds over 60 miles per hour are the main concern, along with large hail, heavy rain, isolated tornadoes, and localized flash flooding. Keeps your phone charged, have a way to receive weather warnings, and move indoors immediately if a warning is issued for your area. And of course, stay tuned to Radio Catskill. Moving right along here, a new independent review has found deep and long-standing problems inside New York's prison system, including a culture of violence, weak oversight, and failure to properly track when correction officers use force. The investigation was ordered after the death of Robert Brooks, who was handcuffed when officers at Marcy Correctional Facility were recorded beating him in December of 2024. While the investigators were examining the system, another incarcerated man, Messiah Nonwheat, was killed by officers at a nearby prison. So joining us now is Chris Giraldi, Justice Bureau Chief for New York Focus, and the reporter behind the story. New York's prisons are stuck in their brutal past, independent review finds. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
So let's talk about, you know, I mentioned briefly what sort of led up to this investigation. Let's just talk about what led up to this investigation and exactly what happened to Robert Brooks.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, as we've talked on the show quite a bit over the past year and a half, the New York State prison system has been in crisis since December 2024. So at that point, as you mentioned in the opening, that's when some guards at Marcy Correctional Facility, which is outside of Utica, were caught on their body cams. They didn't know their body cams were on, beating 43-year-old Robert Brooks, who died just a few hours later from the beatdown. That was a national scandal, actually. It prompted a lot of reporting and a lot of backlash and a lot of questions, like, how could this possibly happen? So as part of that, Governor Kathy Hochul ordered the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision to bring in some like outside consultants to conduct a thorough review of violence in the facilities. And that's sort of like what this report is. So it started with Robert Brooks, but after Robert Brooks, a lot more happened and a lot more sort of like crisis conditions happened in the prisons to make the report, I think, and the outside review even more urgent. As you mentioned, there was another actually murder by prison guards at a facility very close to Marcy Correctional Facility, of 22-year-old Masaya Nantwi. And that happened during a 3-week strike by the corrections officers. So the corrections officers went on strike for a number of reasons. And you know, since then, that strike actually led to a lot of corrections officers being fired. And so now there's this, you know, resulting staffing crisis in the prisons. So needless to say, for the past year and a half, not only have operations been really gummed up in the facilities, but the tensions have been extremely high. And that's sort of like the backdrop for this very, very thorough outside review that was just published a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. So let's talk about the review. You know, what were some of the biggest findings in the report? Was there anything in there that sort of surprised you?
You know, I thought, you know, I cover the prison system pretty extensively. It's the main thing that I cover as part of my beat. So I know a lot of sort of like as much as one can know not being inside the facilities, like how much goes or what goes on in there. And I thought it was very interesting to see like this like outside perspective. You know, the review was conducted by a team of consultants from both like a consultancy agency and a law firm. And they kind of went system by system evaluating sort of what potentially is going wrong inside of the prison system that could lead to something as egregious as two murders by corrections officers. They wrote a lot in the report about what they described as a quote unquote us versus them culture in the facilities, the us being corrections officers and the them being incarcerated people. So, you know, docs higher ups in recent years have pivoted their messaging and I think pivoted a lot of their like policy changes toward making prisons sort of like less punitive and more rehabilitative. That's also a thing that a lot of like legislators have been trying to legislate. And that has not really trickled down into, I think, like the culture of the facilities per this report. The report mentioned that there were like if corrections officers are seen as being too friendly with incarcerated people, they're a bit ostracized. You know, it's like quote unquote inmate lovers. And there was sort of, it seems to be like this like entrenched culture in the facility of separation between incarcerated people and corrections officers, which the report opined can lead to increased tensions and can allow for things like violence, both guards against incarcerated people and then also prisoners against guards to flourish. And yeah, so that was, I think, one of their main findings, which I found pretty interesting because I hear about this kind of thing all the time. But it was very interesting to hear through interviews from like an outside party how that actually plays out in the system.
I just want to go back a little bit about, you know, with the murders that sort of triggered this investigation. How important was the body camera video in bringing attention into this case?
I think it was incredibly important. I don't think that without the body camera video, we would see any of this. We would see the backlash. We would see perhaps even the strike. We would see this very thorough report on On sort of like what is happening, like system by system in the facilities. The body cameras, I think, are hugely important. I've heard for a long time from both corrections officers and incarcerated people and advocates that this kind of violence is relatively routine. It may not always result in someone dying, but that especially guards can sort of like get away with it. So I think seeing it on camera was a huge step in sort of opening people's eyes who don't, spend time in the facilities to the things that like are potentially going on in there. And the body-worn camera, like since Robert Brooks's murder, the prison system has mandated body-worn cameras for all of its corrections officers whenever they're interacting with incarcerated people. It's also like a number of the recommendations in the report relate to like the implementation of and the analysis of and the policy surrounding the use of body-worn cameras and also stationary cameras, which actually aren't as ubiquitous as you might think inside the prison system. So yes, I do think that's a huge part of it. And the prison system is really frantically trying to keep up with the demands for more comprehensive camera coverage in the facilities.
Now, talk about the strike. You know, when that happened, Governor Hochul brought in the National Guard to fill in the empty spots of correctional officers. Are there still National Guards in the prison system?
There are still National Guard. I don't in the prison system. Yes, I don't have an updated number, but that is still very much a thing. This year's state budget allocated hundreds of millions of dollars over the next year for the prison system to do a number of things that it may deem necessary to keep recovering from the strike, among them keeping the National Guard in. So yeah, that I'm working on sort of getting more updated figures and figuring out exactly what the National Guard's evolving role in the facilities look like, but that still very much is a thing.
Yeah. And a side note here, I've spoken to a couple of times to an inmate at Woodburn Correctional Facility here in Sullivan County who's spoke about the correctional of the National Guard being in the prison system. He said he felt more that they treated them more humane compared to correctional officers. This is what his statement is. Have you found that in other incarcerated people that you have spoken to? Sort of that has same
I
feeling
have heard.
that you know the sort of it was run better with the National Guard compared to the correctional officers.
I have heard similar things. I think it really depends on the facility, though. From what I've gathered, how the National Guard is used is more up to the superintendent of each prison. You know, there are 41 prisons in New York State than DOCS's like central office. So it really varies from facility to facility. I have heard they sort of like treat us better thing from quite a few people. There was a funny anecdote from someone that I keep in contact with, actually still during the strike, but she's in one of the women's facilities and was really surprised to hear National Guards members calling her ma'am, which is something that the guards, she couldn't ever imagine the guards doing. Whether or not it's run better, that also really depends facility to facility. I think at a lot of facilities, the presence of National Guard does not necessarily equate to a better run facility. Corrections officers are trained to like do their job. They're trained pretty extensively. They go through a whole training academy. There are countless policies and directives that they need to know and that they need to memorize. You can't just like plop someone in that job just immediately and have them succeed at it. Also, I know that a number of superintendents don't let National Guard do things like escort incarcerated people alone without other corrections officers present. So it's not like you can just like replace one National Guard person with one corrections officer. It's much more complicated than that.
The report mentions groups described as goon squads. What are those?
Yeah, this is something that has been reported a little bit here and there for many years. So a goon squad is effectively or like a quote unquote beat up squad is effectively an informal group of corrections officers in a facility that, that doles out informal justice by taking incarcerated people that they think are problematic or that they think are troublesome, into corners of the facility to basically beat them up and intimidate them. There have been some really, really horribly egregious acts of violence committed by alleged goon squads. I'm thinking they're in the early 2010s. There were, I think, one or two cases where these goon squads actually killed an incarcerated person. It really speaks to sort of, I think, DOCS's a huge theme of the report that I think was really prominent and that really struck me was that it seems that the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision doesn't have a great grasp of what is actually going on in its facilities. I'm talking about like specifically like its central office. It seems to have trouble sort of like tracking like violence hotspots. It seems to reports of use of force can really like fly under the radar, and repeated reports of use of force can fly under the radar. And, you know, at the extreme sort of result of that is things like these beat up squads that can, you know, commit their own violence with pretty much impunity.
Now, what about the use of pepper spray? You know, when exactly is pepper spray supposed to be used? And is there any evidence that the officers use it maybe too quickly?
Yeah, for sure. This sort of like really speaks to the theme I was just talking about of the sort of failure of systems within DOCS, at least in the opinion of the people who wrote this very expansive review. It seems that per these consultants that corrections officers are using like chemical agents like pepper spray more often than they should be allowed to per like DOCS directives. Which that is like a greater theme. There was a really interesting portion in the report where the report writers mentioned interviewing several like recently retired corrections officers who worked at the prisons where Robert Brooks and Masai Enantui were killed. And they were asking them about like their uses of force, and the officers were like sort of describing the times in which they like had to use force against an incarcerated person. And none of the officers said that that force qualified as like excessive force, but, you know, per DOCS directives, according to this report, many of them actually did. And so there seems to be this gap between what the department is saying like policy is and how that policy is implemented, be it just sort of run-of-the-mill uses of force and takedowns, pepper spray, what have you.
And what are some of the health risks for incarcerated people when pepper spray is used?
Well, yeah, it really depends, I think. If you know, I'm not a medical expert, but I know like if you have a respiratory issue, pepper spray can be really terrible for that. Yeah, so that's, I think, like the main concern. That might dovetail with like another pretty common theme in the report that we're talking about, which is medical neglect. Incarcerated people for a long time, and this has been reported by many outside bodies, including journalists, including oversight agencies, that it's very hard to get like specialist medical appointments and like even like emergency medical appointments in many of the prisons. And so when you have violence erupt and then you have sort of like the consequences of that, it's a bit of a double whammy where you have probably violence that was unwarranted and unnecessary, and then, you know, incarcerated people have a hard time recovering from that because they can't really get to a doctor on time.
What role does mental illness and trauma play inside these facilities?
Sure, yeah, I think there's two answers to that. One thing that the report highlighted that I thought was very interesting and appreciated that it dug into this was the role of training staff. From the very get-go, it mentioned that DOCS's training academy is like a paramilitary-style academy. So it's a lot of learning, like the physical aspects. You know, there's classes on like takedowns, and then also seminars on, you know, just like DOCS policy and rules and procedures and all of that. Missing from that, per this report, is sort of like discussion-based training, like how and sort of like role play training, and like how do you actually speak to incarcerated people in a way that continually de-escalates them in a way that keeps sort of everyone at ease. How do you speak to what is often like a very traumatized population, both like traumatized because people who end up in prison are much more likely to have experienced significant trauma and have mental health issues, but also just like sort of like the trauma of being inside prison. And so that was like, that's sort of like a glaring omission from DOCSIS training per this report. Also, it criticized DOCS for not providing enough mental health support for its staff, which is also very important. You know, I was just speaking about like de-escalating situations and sort of like calming down incarcerated people, but that is just as important when you are a staff member in one of these facilities and you're encountering violence on day to day and you're sort of like constantly on edge. The mental health of corrections officers, I would argue, is an extremely important factor in, you know, reducing violence and just like making the prison system run smooth. And the report really said the DOCS could be doing more on that front.
I'm glad you mentioned that part of what's happening there. So what happens now? What did DOCS say it will do next after this report has come out?
It's a great question. I will mention that DOCS had this report for about a week before it decided to send out, to publish it and send out like a press release announcing it. And they did that on Friday, July 3rd, which was like a holiday. It said that it had already accomplished many or like about a dozen of the recommendations that this report plus another sort of shorter report that had many of the same recommendations had put out. A lot of those were around like body cameras and things that sort of DOCS and Governor Hochul had already mandated after the murder of Robert Brooks. It also said that it was in the process of implementing several dozen more of the recommendations. I should have mentioned the report, you know, named a lot of problems and causes, but it was also extremely specific in what it thought DOCS should be doing to remediate them. I believe that this report alone had almost 60 recommendations, some of them short-term, some of them medium-term, some of them long-term. And it acknowledged that many of those recommendations would take of some effort and time and money to implement. None of these recommendations are binding. These are all, this is what DOCS should do, but not what it must do. And DOCS said that it was implementing, in the process of implementing several dozen more in addition to the ones that it already implemented, but it didn't list those. So I think what happens now is the big open question now is, will DOCS take this report seriously, and will it either take its recommendations and you know, like pat the consultants on the head and say thank you very much, this is nice, or will it take this very detailed report as a roadmap for future reform? I know a lot of people who've been pushing for prison reform for a long time are hoping for the latter, but we'll see. And my team at New York Focus, we hope to be tracking how it does on that front in the coming months and year ahead.
We were talking to Chris Giraldi. He's the Justice Bureau Chief at New York Focus. His latest story is titled New York's Prisons Are Stuck in Their Brutal Past and an Independent Review Finds. So, Chris, thank you so much for joining us and help us, you know, better understand the report. And, you know, definitely we'll continue following your reporting on what changes the DOCS actually puts in place and whether those reforms lead to any real accountability and safe conditions for not only the incarcerated people, but like you mentioned before, the prison staff. So, Chris, thank you so much for this. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Great to be here again.
Just a reminder that severe thunderstorms are possible Tuesday afternoon and evening across the southern tier, parts of central New York, the western Catskills, and northeast Pennsylvania. That includes areas around Binghamton, Ithaca, Elmira, Oyanta, Monticello, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre. The highest risk is focused mainly on the south and west of Binghamton, while Sullivan County is in the lower but still serious risk areas. Damaging winds over 60 miles per hour are a main concern, along with hail, isolated tornadoes, and flash flooding. The Daily from the New York Times is coming right up. So take care of yourself. Stay safe out there. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else, take care. I'll talk to you soon.